We're on a mission to explore how emerging technologies, media, robotics, and data and behavioral science will solve humanity's most pressing challenges. From education, mobility, energy, food and water supplies, the environment, employment, all the way to disease and basic human rights. Nothing is off limits. This episode is brought to you by Beverage Universe. They have every flavor to help you stay young, beautiful, and thirsty. Go to beverageuniverse.com for your next flavor experience. Today we have Michelle Tenzik, who's the CEO and founder of East 10th Group and the strategic advisor and executive coach to CEOs. Michelle has over 25 years experience in business as a strategic advisor, and she helps drive actionable people solutions and provides practical insights on business strategy to senior leaders. Michelle, welcome.
Thank you, Terry. Love being here today. Thank you.
Absolutely. Likewise, we really appreciate you taking the time and speaking to us about your expertise. So let's talk a bit about your background and how you got started in HR management and HR systems.
Sure. I have my MBA in HR systems and management. And at the time, it was a long time ago, getting a degree in HR systems was not popular. That was not yet known about in a more mainstream way. And getting that degree, when I did, first of all, the school I went to was really the only school in the country who had that degree. And it made me a choice candidate when I went for interviews, because I was bringing a skill set to bear in the world of HR that not many other people graduating with an MBA had. So I think back on that now, and I think about today, and I go, okay, so today you would look for similar backgrounds in people analytics, AI, and automation in a degree that fundamentally has HR as its undercurrent. And that to me is the most attractive candidate.
What are HR systems? Tell me a bit about.
Yeah, so HR systems at the time was being able to create a system where you warehoused all the employee data in a way that you could access it easily for analytical purposes and for processes. So how do you process analytics around your headcount for an organization? Where do you keep all the fields and data about an employee? Name, address, age, all the things that you need as an employer about your employee in order to pay them, to service them, to give them salary increases, and to manage them well, and also put them in the right places in your company.
Very interesting. What would you say are some of the challenges right now that HR, the HR industry as a whole is facing today?
Yeah, I just read a study coming out of IBM. And what I found so fascinating about this, Terry, is they talked about the need for HR professional themselves to get updated on and reskilled on automation, AI, and systems. Somewhere along the way, HR, I don't know if we derailed or we sort of went off the ranch a bit, but we were not staying as current with technology. HR traditionally can be a very administrative, very task-heavy field. And so the time it takes to implement more efficient systems sometimes is just difficult. Mm-hmm. But today, the first really stop for most organizations is to reskill and uplevel your HR team, so that we can then implement the right solutions for your company on this whole new future of work.
Right. I mean, nowadays with all the different technology that's coming out that could potentially automate a lot of the data entry and administrative tasks that HR professionals traditionally have been tasked to do, now technically frees them to do a lot more.
That's right. So what it frees them to do is more complex decision making and really input on strategy. The automation of data has been around for a while in HR. So, you know, in the early, as I mentioned, the systems, a company called PeopleSoft at the time, which is now Workday, eventually became Workday, or I think I might have had that wrong, but the founder of PeopleSoft also founded Workday. So those kinds of systems have been in and around the HR world for a long time. Even big data analytics has been around now for quite some time in the HR world. And automating an employee self-service. So I join a company and my ability to access my paycheck, change my tax deductions, and so forth is online. I have a service center I go to. However, where the push now is happening is it's being pushed in recruiting, onboarding, predictive analytics about where I'm going to need the talent when, and even quality of talent. So it's now in its next phase and iteration to take away any of the manual tasks and completely automate that. So it frees me up as an HR professional to really be involved in setting strategy for the organization in a much more meaningful way.
Very interesting. Tell me about how big data. I'm always fascinated with that subject because big data usually doesn't give you the type of insight, or, you know, you can kind of manipulate the insight to give you what you want it to give you. But how does that play a role in decision-making in HR in general? Like, what is that used
for? Yeah, so a great example is I knew the second in charge of HR for Halliburton and global VP of human resources. And when you think about in Halliburton, and with the multitude of oil rigs around the world and the production of the oil and the labor that's needed to be on the oil rig, depending on how oil is coming through or not, that's where big data and analytics comes in for human resources, right? So how do I determine and predict who I need when on the rigs in order to maximize the production effort at a particular point in time. So to me, that's in a large sense, but yet it's quite powerful when you think about it, right? So that's not only big data analytics, but it's also using predictive analytics so that I understand how to manage my labor market well as I need to meet demand as I need to around the world.
And that's where, I guess, artificial intelligence, machine learning, and, you know, predictive modeling is now kind of piggybacking on top of big data and beginning to create a lot more interesting ways of using the data to.
And I agree with that. I completely agree. Because when I think about big data, I think for a while it was big data for the sense of, oh, I have all this data, I'm going to mine it, I'm going to look at it, and then what? Right? And then what? So do I then have to go back and have the human intervention, right, to understand the data? And now, no, there are now systems, mainly AI, that will interpret that data for me. And then my role is, okay, now take the action based on what the data has told me and been interpreted to tell me. So it's really quite a nuanced but dynamic change to big data.
Yes, and one of the things I think that are very controversial, especially in the HR industry when it comes to AI, is I think you and I talked about this before, is the type of algorithms that are coded to interpret the data have their own biases built into them, because of the nature of what AI actually is and what it does, is it consumes the information based on the input that it's receiving, and then based on the rules that have been programmed in its core, it spits out information back. I mean, this is a very interesting subject matter, I think, in general, because there's no answer or no solution. We don't know yet.
We don't know. Because what we were talking about is, and something that has been highlighted to me in talking about AI is, okay, so in order for AI to actually work, at some point, humans are doing something to either input the data, integrate the data. So there is a human intervention at some point with AI. and who's around that table who's actually influencing that integration to make the AI solution work. And if I'm looking at technology today in the STEM areas, we still have an underrepresentation of a full diverse workforce, mm-hmm. right? That's supporting
massively
even the front end of AI. And so then you ask yourself questions, then is there an inherent bias built in on the front end, almost what they call as unconscious bias, not even knowing, but yet that's built in. And so therefore the results from AI have a bias in them.
Yes.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
So there's a colleague of mine who now has founded her own organization, company, coming out of the AI space on the legal components and ethical components, right, of mm-hmm. AI and what's going to happen. And we talked about just this case where it's been proven that certain ways of AI working well gets influenced on that front end and what might be the bias. And I think you were the one who told me an example, which I still think is hilarious, on the Twitter feed and Microsoft and the bot that was unleashed on Twitter, right? Mm-hmm. And then all of a sudden, based on interactions with whomever was reacting to it, people-wise, it started spitting out tweets that might have been seen as very inappropriate.
Because
it was learning, right? Because it was learning as it went, but being influenced by the human intervention and therefore comes out with what is extremely biased, extremely problematic for Microsoft.
Yes, exactly. I mean, it was kind of launched as this innocent, happy, cute little bot who was not programmed to expect this type of behavior. And of course, it didn't have any ways to filter it out. Mm-hmm. So the filtration system within the intelligence that was created for Twitter was kind of faulty, in my opinion. Mm-hmm. I think that's where it flopped.
And what really comes to mind when I hear you say that is I think about, you know, what I do for a living today, what my company does for a living today, which is, you know, supporting leaders and their organizations to, you know, reach their full potential and realize their strategic plans. The leaders today, because I'm actually doing a vision session with one of the CEOs and companies we partner with tomorrow. Their future is dependent in that organization on AI and automation. It just will be. And so when I think about this leader's ability to articulate a vision for the future, right? We think about visions, big idea, big goal, maybe feels not reachable. You want to put something big out there. He's got to be influenced by what's happening in the automation world for his organization and the clients that they service. And that takes an incredible amount of emotional intelligence because you really have to be sensitive, knowledgeable. You have to have the wherewithal to go, okay, I may not completely understand what's coming down the pike, what's all of this is going to mean in 10 to 20 years, but I've got to take that into consideration when setting a vision. And that means you're going to have a high level of emotional intelligence. So you need to have that sensitivity and wherewithal about what will my workforce potentially look like come 10 years when my vision may be realized.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely, which is something that Amazon is grabbing a lot of headlines right now, where they just announced that by, I believe, 2025, they're going to retrain, reskill, or upskill their workforce, half of its workforce. Or a third of its workforce.
It's 100. I think it's 100,000.
Yes,
100,000 folks. Right?
Number like that.
It's crazy. It's crazy.
And other companies have joined this movement, like AT&T and Walmart, WMT, and so forth. J.P. Morgan Chase, Accenture. And I mean, I think it's very interesting that they're seeing it. They know what's happening.
Well, they're getting ahead of it. Right. Mm-hmm. It's no different than Amazon, JP Morgan, and Berkshire Hathaway coming together to form Haven and start addressing the healthcare issues in their organization for over a million employees, right, and addressing what that needs to look like as opposed to waiting for government to solve that issue. So there is no doubt that in that frame, they are using AI and automation to solve for that healthcare need for their million plus employees. And so why wouldn't they do the same for their, for these employees in terms of upskilling and training them to best service the consumer population that they need to reach in the future? And why lose your workforce, right? Because that skill set is not available anywhere for the most part, right? Or if it is available, it's available in so small quantities, it's not enough to remain competitive and be the leader in the marketplace. So somewhere employers have to make the investment in their own people that they have who are willing and able. And that's, you know, typical. So there's going to be employees who put their hands up. There's going to be employees who are sort of step back and go, no, not yet. I don't think I can do that. And then the employees who go, yeah, not for me. Those employees will lose out. They will lose employment because it's going to be much harder to find something that they can do if they don't get upskilled.
What would you recommend that people do to on their own right now to keep their skills not just relevant, but, you know, future thinking or future forward to be able to meet the demand of the workforce in the next 10 years?
Yeah, there's so much available right now online, right? In the HR field, there was a course that came out last, I don't remember, it was the summer, early fall, put out by the organization called The Future of Work. And it was on AI for HR. I signed up. I took it. It was a 5-week course online using combined AI as well as automation, a great learning platform. So I was exposed to new tools and new ways of doing work. And it gave me a deep dive into lots of different applications and AI-supported solutions within HR. That is what I recommend, is just get yourself up to speed. Don't be afraid of reading, learning, and looking. There is tons of free courses out there. In fact, Google has released, they were up-leveling their employees for AI, and their course on, I think, I don't know if it's called Google for AI, so I don't want to be quoted on that, but it's something within that. You can Google it.
Exactly.
You can Google it.
Google
and you'll find
friend.
It. And it's free. It's in the public domain and free. So why not get yourself exposed? And the more exposure you have, the less fear you have then. The more then you feel you're capable and I can do it. Or if I'm not going to do it, I'll find a partner who can do it.
Right, exactly. Amazon, which is one of my favorite use cases to always just kind of look at what they're doing going forward. You can gauge a lot about just technology in general and their consumer centered approach to the business and how they do things is actually replacing a lot of their workforce. And I think this is part of the reason why they're retraining and reskilling and upskilling. They're replacing a lot of their workforce with robotics technology, where they're going out and they're picking and packing and delivering the orders to a human being who then takes care of the final stages. And this is something not even that recent. I mean, this is something that's kind of becoming the norm, I believe, in most of the larger retail chains that are competing with Walmart. But I thought that was really fascinating that Amazon now is able to compete with one of the biggest retail giants of the world, Walmart. And Walmart is becoming somewhat concerned about Amazon.
Mm-hmm. Finally. Well, I think they've been concerned about Amazon. I think everybody is. Amazon is pretty much taking over the world. When I think about that, a couple of years ago, I was in the Midwest and for a conference, and we were at a particular company that's a manufacturing company, and we got to see the plant that was extraordinarily antiquated. I mean, you could just feel it. The building itself, the machinery, you know, they were priding themselves. Well, this was the original machine, and that's what, and I just went, interesting. We then went the next day to see the F-150 plant for Ford that was being run by robotics. Now, there were people on the assembly line, right, managing certain handoffs of the robotics, but it was bright, it was airy, it was modern. There were people on the floor, but again, the robotics were putting on the door, putting on the hood, putting on the handle, and then it's moving to the next section. Now, what has to happen is why people are needed is to ensure that it moves to the next section and the work was good, right? So you're doing a quick quality control check at that moment. So robotics has been around, as you said. This is nothing new, and it's a matter of where do people get plugged into the robotics, where the human touch and human sensibility is still required to ensure that the output is what you want it to be.
Mm-hmm. And that's the last mile problem.
And that's what Amazon is contending with now is, yes, robotics, but are we sure that it was done in a quality way and there's going to be a certain human intervention that's required for that? And let's not forget, though, this is where we talked about upskilling. So if you think about those kinds of robotics, now you need more people who understand the robotics, right? And how does that work? In order to intervene in the machine that might be doing that. And that's an upskilling. No different than the industrial age where, you know, the automation lines came into play and you needed to have people who understood how that automation line worked.
Yeah, I hear all the time that, AI and robotics, they're just going to replace all jobs and we won't have any jobs. To me, it doesn't make sense because I feel like we've gone through quite a number of industrial revolutions over just even the short period of time that I've been alive, forget about in the last 150 years. And this is just another example of that. This is just another way that we're going to shift the way that we do work. And that's been happening for quite a while now. You know, same thing with, when farming equipment change. We no longer needed hard manual labor to do those things. And what happened to all the farmers? Well, they became machine operators. They started working in the factories. And what did that do? Well, we started having cars instead of carriages. Well, what did having cars do? Well, we can now travel much faster, get more, you know, everything just kind of contributes to getting more work done, being more efficient. Same thing with the computer. Oh, you know, everybody thought when the computer came out that it's going to just put everybody out of work. Well, no, it actually put a lot more people into work. So every time I hear this fear-based argument for people telling me about, AI is just going to destroy everything. It's going to, you know, put us all, you know, have us all be homeless and have no jobs and you know, we won't be able to do anything. Yeah. I say, why? Why is that your argument? Yeah. You know, where do you get this sense that that's what's going to happen?
Yeah, I think it's, I was just thinking, I was laughing to myself. When I was going for my graduate degree, we went to a computer lab to sign on to maybe the one or few computers that we had to do the work, right? And today, you know, we all have one laptop. We might have multiple laptops, right? And that's just the way it works. And it wasn't less employment needed. It was more employment needed because of the advent of how much technology brings to life in general. It's just different work. There's a very sophisticated, leading edge Chinese gentleman. I don't remember his name, but he talked about that, yes, in the next decade, 40% of the current workforce will be completely changed. So meaning either you will lose your job or you will have an upskilled and your job will have changed and what you do is going to change. But it is going to be that massive. So no different than I needed to come out of the computer lab and get used to using a laptop and or a desktop at the time and that we all had computers and learn all those programs. It's no different today. And so there is a little bit of a jump on board or you will get left behind. And so that's human nature. Some of us will grab onto it. Others will be a little more resistant. But it's coming, and it's coming fast. And that's just, that I think is causing more overwhelm because of the speed mm-hmm. now of these changes. People feel overwhelmed by that. Mm-hmm. And that's where employers have a lot of responsibility and lots of opportunity to really dynamically help their workforce change. Otherwise, they as an organization will get left behind. I mean, look at how many companies are no longer in existence. There's a number of them on my resume that are not in existence for lots of different reasons. Mm-hmm. So that's where we're headed now. And I'm wondering, will Walmart exist in the foreseen future? Mm-hmm. Or will they have to so dynamically change in order to remain competitive with an Amazon and offer a different way of buying retail?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Which industries do you think will be most disrupted at the very beginning?
And retail. Retail without. I just walked past, I was coming over here and I was walking past the Brook Brothers store and I sort of went, does anybody shop in Brook Brothers anymore? But they now have a full coffee cafe in there to create more of an experience mm-hmm. for their shoppers, right? So, hey, if I come in here for coffee, maybe I'll also look around. And so it really is about that retail experience now, which we're seeing the change happening. So it's no longer just going into retail stores and having racks of clothing or shoes. It's about how do I create an experience for someone to want to come in to be in this store and to do something while I'm in the store. But retail by far, in my opinion, is changing the most. And then automotive. So that would be second, is that automotive is going to change massively with the advent of self-driving cars, flying cars, that's coming, and healthcare. If you think about healthcare right now, you know, one part that is already you can see changing depending on where you decide to go for your medical services is the ability for a multitude of doctors to get my records, to see my record in one place so that they all know what's going on with me. So healthcare is massive and it needs to be because it's complex, but that is going automotive and retail, and I would put those three on very similar trajectories of massive change.
Yeah, absolutely. I was reading an article, I think it was in Forbes, talking about how specifically the grocery store industry has just really changed and evolved because people don't want to go to the grocery store anymore, apparently. And the way that large chains are changing that, and a lot of times the grocery stores are in the forefront of innovation because they have to. They're changing it into experiences. So you'll walk into a Whole Foods and it's a cafe or it's a French
that's type right.
of restaurant.
Yeah, it's to get you in there.
Old time butcher, and you know everything is kind of virtualized where you get to experience the foods in addition to the environment. And that apparently brings people in a lot more, and it has them buying more
food.
Yeah,
it does. Well, it's funny. I don't live in the city, and I live outside the city, a little north of Manhattan. And I go to what I would consider a fairly traditional grocery store, but I do self-shopping. So I, you know, as soon as they put that in, I got my own little thing to get my groceries, to, you know, scan the pricing myself, so then it's a very easy, you know, bring my own bags, everything's bagged, I don't have to deal with the checkout counter. But the other day, I was in that store a couple weeks ago, and I heard someone say, may I help you? And it was a robot wandering around the store, checking if I needed anything. It was a little disturbing, but I was like, oh, okay. Mm-hmm. So now we have robots, right, helping to make sure I'm okay in the store.
What did you tell him? Her.
I think I was so shocked, Terry, by the fact that I had a robot talking to me in the grocery store, I walked the other way. But next time I will interact because I'm fascinated now that I'm a little over my shock. Like, what are they going to help me with?
And you're killing me now. So what did it look like?
It looks like a Segway in a way. I mean, that's what it made me think of, although it was tall and had some kind
dark
of smiley
face.
Yeah. Wishful thinking. I would have had them do all my shopping then. With a smile on the face, it was just really
odd. Like a
smiley
face?
Yeah.
Like two dots and a...
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. But again, I looked so quickly because it was so disturbing to me.
Right now,
I had to look away and I just went... But next time I will interact.
So
yes.
Interesting.
Right?
What grocery store was that?
A Stop and Shop. Yeah.
I gotta check that out.
right? But then, you know, you have all the home delivery, right? So that's right. Changed.
Yeah.
And, you know, yes, has it now reduced the need for cashiers in a grocery store? Absolutely. So people who are skilled at being at a grocery line as their job or packing groceries, those people are losing their jobs. That's real. I mean, that's mm-hmm. not happening.
Right.
And then what will people in those kinds of roles do? I don't really have an answer for that. I don't know. There's at some point, you know, even when I think about Stop and Shop and the woman in this particular store that stacks and puts in the vegetables, the fresh vegetables. Well, in a number of years, that will go away. There will be a robot putting those vegetables in their places. Right. And you won't need, because it will be quicker, faster. You won't need the human doing that kind mm-hmm. of work. And so what will that person do? I don't know. I don't know if right. they get reskilled or able to become something else, or do they lose their jobs? But just like in the industrial ages of, you know, initial automation, there were people that lost their jobs and it was really challenging for them.
Right. They even have now technology where you can just simply walk out of the threshold of the store and it automatically scans the
That's
items
right. yes.
and it charges your card.
That's right.
So you don't even need a cashier at that point.
That's right.
Their challenge, however, is to make sure that they charge the right people for the right things. So I guess the geolocator or yeah. the scanner or the sensor or an IoT device, I'm sure it has to be accurate most of the time, or they'll have a massive consumer issue on their hands. But well, that's coming.
And if you think about, you know, toll roads, right? So we used to go through the toll booth, you know, we'd have someone there that we'd get a ticket from or we'd give money as we were driving along. Now they have all the over, they're taking out all the toll booths and it's just the overhead, you know, cameras, technology, et cetera, that are picking up a signal from your car, whether or not you have the pass or not, right? Mm-hmm. Many of us have heard of Easy Pass. You're going to get somehow mailed at home. It's working. The technology is working. Like all the bridges in the New York City area, all the toll booths are out. And it's all overhead and it makes life so much easier and right. faster. So all of those individuals, what are they doing today? I don't know what they're doing. Right?
Right.
But somehow they're working somewhere. They're finding jobs elsewhere or they're getting skilled up.
Right.
Hold that thought. Let's take a quick break and thank our sponsors. The production of the Amplified podcast has been brought to you by Social Fix Media. Social Fix is a transformational growth hacker agency focused on emerging technology platforms, video and podcast production, content marketing, and overall startup strategy. SocialFix has helped over 300 clients generate millions of dollars in revenue, fundraising, and profit. If you'd like help launching or growing your business, visit socialfix.com.
I don't know how close this is to actually coming to fruition, but I was reading about technology that's going to change the road material itself, where roads will be able to self-direct themselves and change to avoid traffic and fix themselves, and potholes.
Wow. Will that I've not
like
heard.
It's some type of plasma or whatever they're
wow.
going to be using to make the roads. So, you know, even construction is, I think, one of the industries that will be very significantly impacted, because right now everything is done manually, where the land surveillance, the,
That's right.
You know, actually going through and looking at the land in 3D and figuring out, you know, or x-raying it or whatever it is that they do to see what's underneath, you know, all of that is going to be, I think, significantly changed,
mm-hmm.
And it's already happening, even in the manual, especially in the manual labor
yeah.
Industries.
Well, I think what's important is, and this is where I think the human resource profession has such an opportunity, is, you know, I'm even getting overwhelmed listening to this. Like, what? I didn't hear about the road thing. I mean, that's new. It's almost, you know, every day, every other day, every week, all depending on what you're reading, listening to, Googling, looking at, that you're going to hear something new in this world of future of work, as we call it. The opportunity for HR, though, in companies is to help bring their leaders and their teams along with this and not make it something to be afraid of or overwhelmed. And by embedding this in the way the company is operating, right, making sure that whether there is ongoing podcasts or there are leaders communicating in a particular way or easy access to information and giving employees actually time to look at this kind of information is all within the HR responsibility. And so HR can have such an absolute critical role going forward in how companies are orchestrating their understanding of these changes, taking on these changes, and letting people feel okay with them, that it's not something to be as overwhelmed with, that it's going to be okay, and this is what you do about it, and by exposing people to it. So HR is key in all of that.
What do you feel right now just being in the HR forefront? What is being done right now to help people get reskilled, upskilled, or lead CEOs or lead CMOs, CTOs, and so forth into this coming shift that's happening?
Yeah, so I think what's interesting about that is that the kinds of companies that we work with are primarily in what we define as the middle market. So usually about 50 million revenue, upward of a billion. So we're not in the large, we're not in the Facebooks, we're not in the Amazons and so forth. And so a lot of our clients have, there's limited dollars in terms of what they can spend and make the investment in. And so what my reaction has been is they feel to me a little behind. And what I mean by that is if you take a very technology savvy, forward thinking organization, and I think I mentioned this company to you a while ago, Enigma, who is in the big data analytics space and more than that. I'm a little behind probably in what they've done up to now. So a company like an Enigma that's about 125 employees, they are putting in squads to how they do cross-functional work in the organization. So I'm on a squad for 90 day attached to a project with a number of the other people in the company. And then I switch out after 90 days and move on to another role. So HR to me is helping because they're helping to orchestrate that. And they're helping to put in mechanisms for the managers to evaluate the work and to provide feedback in a meaningful, real-time way. Larger middle market firms, however, there are some fundamental challenges with the amount of resources they have to be as agile as they need to be. And that's where I'm going to go back to. It is incumbent upon the leadership team to not shy away from all things AI and automation and to literally do deep dives into it so that they can position their employees and their people for what is already here and then ensure that they remain competitive. So that might mean making some distinct differences in investments in order to have that competitive edge going forward. And those are tough decisions. Those aren't easy decisions to make, but they're going to be necessary to make.
How would you recommend a middle market CEO, you know, let's say Fortune 1000 company, what would be the steps that they should take or how should they even begin?
Yeah, so I think a couple of ways. I think one of the CEOs we work with just attended a disruption conference at MIT. Fantastic. Just getting exposed to what's going on and especially outside what might be your own industry. So getting influenced by other industries and other CEOs in terms of what they're being challenged with. Another CEO we work with in the industrial space, I encourage them to go to the Ideas Festival in Aspen in June. Why? Because there is broader global thinking that's happening there. It's interspersed with economics and the marketplace and the worldview, which then brings you back to your home base, influenced by other ideas and thoughts, and you can start formulating what your future dynamically really needs to look like. The other thing that just occurred to me today that I would recommend to a CEO in that position is also to be thinking about if we can't move our environment from within, what acquisition might I have to look at to help drive this for the future? So go out and find potentially a very technology forward, smaller organization that you can then tack on to your own, which will propel that advancement.
Very smart. Yeah, a lot of tech companies are getting scooped up. A lot of creative companies now are getting scooped up because I feel that the creative industry is going to be one of the last ones disrupted in terms of problem solving and just creative problem solving and so forth. But it's going to be also one of the industries that will be the highest in demand, creative aspect.
Love that you talked about that, because when I'm reading now about what is the human skill set that's going to be most needed is complex decision making, strategic thinking, and creativity. Because even, you know, my suggesting that maybe a bit of a staid organization that still has a place in the world, that still has customers, still has a particular market share, thinking about how do I add on a technology company into the mix, you need to be creative to think that through. And you also need to be a risk taker, right? You're going to, especially if you're publicly traded, you've got to convince your board, you know, your constituents, your shareholders, and so forth, that that's a good investment. But yet that's what the future is. And that takes a tremendous amount of creativity and forethought. So you're right, Terry. You're 100% right. And I've just seen that in actually some research.
Yeah. And you know, a lot of people that are creative, I feel like erroneously believe that they're not meant for the technical industry. But that's where the diversity of algorithms come in. That's where the creative problem solving and the enhancement of the AI, it needs that. The way that I kind of visualize it is that the stage that we're in right now with AI, it's a little tiny infant, little baby. I mean, that's what we have on our hands, and we need to train this intelligence or this, you know, this awareness into seeing what the world is like and being able to make those decisions, but we're nowhere near that.
No. No, but it's coming fast, right?
Yes.
So if we have this conversation 3 years from now, there will already be substantial changes to what we'd be talking about.
Yes, 100%.
I mean, that's just the facts. You know, in a year, 2 years, I'm not sure, but by the three-year point, yeah. In fact, the way we're even recording this podcast might be very different in 3 years.
We might be just thinking it.
That's right. We could be, exactly.
You'll be hearing
that's
it.
Right. That's right. Well, it's interesting. I think there's some commercials now. Yes, I'm still a TV watcher. There's some commercials on TV that are using, you know, what the future might look like, right? Watching a TV show through glasses and being able to just fast forward quickly to get to the spot that I want to get to, and not needing to be in front of, you know, never mind even streaming, that I'm just able to project that wherever I'm standing. So is it going to get here? Sure it is. I don't think we ever thought flying cars were going to get here, but they are. They're already here. They're already testing them.
Yes, exactly. If anybody wants to see a real flying car, CES 2020.
That's right. 2020 CES, no doubt about it.
Talking about the technology that's coming, holography is one of the most fascinating subjects, I think, in general. One, because I think most people, like me, assume that the phone, our phone that I'm attached to that you wouldn't recognize me if I put it down, will be around for a while. But in actuality, there are companies right now working to actually put that out of business.
That's right.
And have the phone be a hologram that's displayed on any surface, and the technology behind it could be bio somehow triggered.
I think it's hard for any of us to imagine that our smartphones, which we all are now attached to and are, you know, you see 1 year and 2 year olds using them, that they are going to go by the wayside. Our smartphones are not going to exist. My projection on that is, and only this is from watching, again, this gentleman from China who's a leader in this space. And I believe he said, I think he said it was in 5 years, I might be misquoting him, that our smartphones are going away. They're not. And that's sort of like, what? Are you kidding me? How will I exist without that? Well, there will be something else that will take its place.
Exactly. I mean, the phones replaced the computers.
That's right.
And now there's something coming that's replacing the phone.
That's right.
and that, that will be happening much sooner than imagined. And then I don't know what we're going to do. We're all going to be part of the gig economy.
Yeah, you know, I think that's an interesting part of the conversation, right? Because the gig economy is now, right, where many companies are utilizing a variety of ways to get at what they need to produce the work. So it's not unheard of that a team that I might be collaborating with has people who are full-time on the team, who are getting their pay from that employer on a full-time basis, but it's going to be interspersed with people working virtually, people working from around the globe. There's going to be add-on skill sets that we don't have internally in the company. And you're just seeing that more. People, and when you think about it, people are freer to work from anywhere, and that has promoted the gig economy. And if you go back to the example I used on Enigma, right? So if they're putting together squads, which says, okay, I need to be on a project for 90 days, and then I'm going to move on to another project because that work, the work that I needed to do is done, and yet it's exciting for me and motivating for me because I get to move on to something else, that supports the gig economy. That allows someone who wants to, quote unquote, freelance or not be attached to any one company, move around quite easily. I think it was interesting. I met a group of young graduates a couple of years ago coming out. I want to say they were coming out of the New School. It was either Baruch or the New School. They were forming already their own conglomerate of different skill sets as opposed to joining up with a company. So they had found that they liked each other in the school environment. They had different technological skills for the most part, graphic design, communicate, all different pieces. And they were joining together to become this offering, right? Is mm-hmm. here, we're going to have all these different skill sets. I thought it was the smartest thing ever. Like, mm-hmm. why not? Right? Mm-hmm. I don't have to get attached to a company. I can just mm-hmm. share my skills and get hired out, and they'll get hired. I have mm-hmm. no doubt that they're probably doing well today. Probably tripped up a little bit, but I'm sure they're doing well.
As any startup trips up.
That's right. Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Something that's been on the horizon, I think, with more and more intensity lately is a couple of companies, obviously the big tech giants, Amazon, Facebook, Google, etc. But Uber and Lyft have also begun experimenting pretty heavily with autonomous driving cars. And it feels like, you know, Uber was such a innovative, disruptive type of company where it didn't own anything. It didn't employ anyone. It had no assets. It just had this app. But it had the power to put millions of people to work. Now, it also has the power to put millions of people out of work.
That's right.
And I feel like a lot of people are very stressed out, very nervous mm-hmm. about what's going to happen specifically in the driver industry.
Listen, I mean, that's you think about now flying into New York and LaGuardia or JFK and whatever, and we're all out there getting our, you know, cars. There are some people who still are in the taxi line, but that certainly has gone down. You know, taxi medallions in the New York area used to be over $1 million. Now, I don't even know what the price is. I'm going to say maybe $100,000 at most. So, mm-hmm. and you're putting taxi cabs out of work. I mean, they mm-hmm. don't have jobs. And what are those folks doing? I can't tell you what they're doing. I haven't asked a taxi driver as of late. You know, where else are you going for work if this is no longer your job? And certainly now, if the next disruption of this industry is they will be self-driving cars, so I won't need actually a driver in it, then what are those workers going to do? Just as all of a sudden there was plenty of workers to drive Ubers, they came from somewhere, right? There will be the next thing that those drivers can do. I mean, I have to be hopeful on that. Because otherwise, yeah, there'll be a lot. Same with truck drivers, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, there is now a need for truck drivers. We don't have enough truck drivers. We just don't. People are not getting into that field. But yet you sort of say to yourself, okay, well, but are we going to need truck drivers in the foreseen future regardless of the challenge right now, is there's not enough of them.
Right. There's a lot of professions that are, I think, lacking.
Yeah, the trades. Sets. Yeah, the trades. The trades are definitely lacking people coming into that, because the folks in grammar school and high school aren't necessarily thinking about the trade as a way to make a living. Yet it can be an excellent way to make a living, but they're not thinking about that. Because if you think about a tall building going up in any big city, for the most part, regardless of cranes and other things, the likelihood of not needing human beings to help put that building up, I think for the foreseen future, human beings will need to help put that building up. And so those trades will be required. And so perhaps with, I don't know, I'm just thinking this off the top of my head, perhaps now with all this advent of automation and people who may not be able to be upskilled in that side of the equation, they'll end up going over to the trade side. Possibly, I don't know.
Right.
Because that could be a possible place for them to get employment and work.
Yeah, and then, you know, on one side you have the talent acquisition panic, and on the other side you have the unemployment panic.
Yeah, you do.
Which point of view is actually the accurate depiction of what's happening? Because on one end I feel like we can't get enough people to come through that have the skill set that's needed. And on the other side, people are saying that, you know, they're going to be replaced.
Yeah. So on the talent acquisition side, and this is only my opinion, I'm not going to be able to quote facts and figures to back this up. Companies, it feels like the ones that I'm exposed to in the last few years, even with the tightening of the talent market, are hiring the square to fit in the square. It's exact fit to the job that they're hiring for, as opposed to hiring for potential. And I am going to give an example of this. Back in the day, in the advent of, you know, the early 2000s, when we had all of the online startups, I was working for a startup that we were competing with Travelocity and Expedia. And I remember when we were doing our hiring, we were hiring for jobs that we didn't even quite know yet. What would they do? Like, what is it? I think we know the need sort of, but not really, because the whole world of online and e-commerce and making money was still trying to be figured out. We hired for potential. We did a lot of hiring for potential, which to me was a really smart hiring decision. And it all worked out for us. Today, companies need to take the risk and hire for potential and then provide the learning, because right now some of that learning is not expensive, right? There's plenty of learning platforms that are making it very dynamic and easy for people to get skilled as they're in that role if they've got the motivation and the desire to do the great work. So I'm hopeful that more companies take on that attribute of hiring for potential, especially in a talent shortage, because there are people who really want to be working and just may not yet have the skill set. It doesn't mean they're not the right fit for you, because what I hear, even if I go back to Enigma as an example, culture, values, environment still have a stronghold on any company today. It still matters. And so the fit of someone to my culture, to my vision and my values is incredibly important for the long term. And so if you really are demonstrating potential and your ability to want to learn and know more, why wouldn't I hire you even if you don't have the exact skill set yet for that role?
So how do you measure those soft skills? How do you determine that someone is a good fit when it comes to culture, environment, and so forth?
So I haven't read this yet, but I'm expecting probably when I leave here, I'll read it. AI is going to help with all of that, right? I mean, AI right now on the HR front is huge on the recruiting and onboarding. So if you're able to figure out my fit competency-wise on my technical capabilities, you're also going to be able to feed in data into whatever system it is or application that I'm using to assess your fit. And in fact, I only looked at it briefly, but I'm pretty sure the IBM study with, of course, Watson at the forefront of that talks about that ability to get the fit right of someone through AI mechanisms, and that that should come first as opposed to the rest of my technical skill set coming first. But that ability is in there.
Very interesting. Right? So the EQ should come first before the actual IQ test.
That's my opinion.
Very interesting. Yeah. I'm really curious on how we're going to actually measure, you know, resilience, tenacity, ability to not quit, ability to iterate your process. And that brings me to my next point. How do we build algorithms that can assess these skills that don't even necessarily may exist in the person at the time, but they're there?
Yeah. So here's it, right? And I will make sure I get you this IBM paper because it's really interesting. So if you think about if you have a sizable workforce and you start looking at and you start analyzing length of service, kind of work that someone's been doing, their ability to manage in the ups and downs of the business, now I start pulling out that information out of algorithms, right? Because I start getting the data out. I start looking at the compilation of the workforce. I start to see who was able to sustain during certain periods of challenge, who left, who actually exited and resigned, right? So who's no longer there? And then while they were there, what was that, you know, what was their behaviors or actions that kept them there? So they are starting I might be behind times already. It's out there. Is it out there that's prevalent? Not yet. But is it coming? It sure is. That I will have that ability through AI and analytics to do that and predictive analytics. Take one action immediately after listening to this podcast that will contribute to your learning in and around the world of AI and automation, whatever that might be for you, but take one action. You can do it today. You don't have to wait. Do it today. Read something, Google something, talk to someone, look into a new app, whatever that might be. But the one action that you can take, because as soon as you take an action, it feels like it's possible.
So Michelle, how can people find you?
Sure. So people can find us at east10thgroup.com. And welcome you to come to our website, check us out, see what we're up to, see what we're doing. And you can always email me at Michelle, M-I-C-H-E-L-L-E, at east10thgroup.com. Be happy to hear from you or take any of your questions or thoughts. Thank you.
Perfect. Well, thank you very much for joining us on the Amplified podcast. You are a treasure trove of really valuable information. It is very clear that you have a lot of experience working with high-level CEOs and executives and guiding and steering them to finding the right solutions that will help them continue on and grow their businesses. So we appreciate you.
Thank you. Loved being here.
Thanks for listening to the Amplified podcast. Follow us on our social channels and subscribe on Apple and Google Podcasts, Spotify, Podbean, or wherever you get your podcasts. On the next episode, stay tuned for more trailblazing insights, energy, and culture to help fuel your pursuit in the modern digital era.